Hugh Gottschalk, an attorney in Colorado, leads us in yet another perspective on alternative legal services pricing. He also discusses understanding the costs of your services, budgeting for litigation, and structuring the actual fee agreement with the client. These discussions should be considered in light of the reasonableness of legal fees, and most importantly, how the lawyer can deliver quality services at a price that will produce a reasonable profit for the lawyer at an acceptable price to the client.
Our topic today is alternative fee arrangements, or as one attorney describes it, really a pricing structure. And in today's world, the preeminent method of billing is based on the hour. And my question, I guess, is, has this always been the way that lawyers have billed for their services? And if not, how did we get to where we are today?
Well, I'm 51, have been practicing since 1979, and it has certainly been the predominant method of billing during my career. I have heard folklore from older lawyers, particularly in the younger days of my career, that in times gone by, in the 30s and 40s and 50s, it was not, and that it evolved in the 50s and 60s to the hourly rate being predominant. I'm not sure I know how it got to be that way. What I do know is up until the last 2 years, it was clear the predominant way that lawyers billed for their time.
Well, I guess there's been a lot of dissatisfaction in recent times expressed with the methodology of billing by the hour. And I know there's a lot of pressure on it, particularly since bar associations can no longer be involved with the process. Is there anything right with the system?
Clearly there is. I think there can be improvements. And I guess my overwhelming reaction to discussions about types of billing is to recognize that there are, it is a billing process, or any billing process covers engagements by lawyers to do small divorces, covers engagements by Wall Street firms to do mergers and acquisitions of billion-dollar companies, covers engagements of lawyers to do personal injury litigation. It covers the gamut. And its obvious benefit is that it allows the client to purchase and pay for exactly the proportion of or the amount of work that is needed, and to not have to worry about overestimating or underestimating. So at a very functional level, I think it works fine for what it does.
What's wrong with the system?
The obvious problem with hourly billing is it incents the lawyer to increase the amount of time spent, or maybe a more fair way to say it is not to look for ways to cut corners and cut time. The more time spent, the more money made, and there's obviously a natural financial incentive, even if you assume good faith and fairness on all sides. It creates an incentive on the margins to do more rather than less and charge more rather than less.
Well, I suppose we're talking about margins and not the bulk of the legal community, and that's good to know. But I guess the follow-up question then would be, if it is inequitable, as you're suggesting, because it incentivizes lawyers not to look for the most effective or efficient way to practice, why is it that we're still using it? And why is it that it seems so many clients still prefer the old way or the hourly billing method instead of some new way?
Well, I'll go back. I'm not sure I would agree with your word inequitable. I don't think it is inequitable. I think it works. I do not think most lawyers abuse or consciously overcharge clients. It just creates an incentive, which across the gamut systemically can be criticized for encouraging unnecessary work at the margins. But going to your question, the alternate way of doing it is to fix a price instead of a fluctuating price that you can agree $200 an hour and somebody will keep track of the hours and there's your price. The alternative way of doing it takes work. It takes planning. It takes analysis. It takes agreement on both sides. And I think in many cases where the amount and the nature of the work is not well defined, it is difficult to find agreement, to get the client and the lawyer to agree on what the fee will be in advance.
I know these are not your words. Let me put it into my words. Because you talk about the requirement to plan, to budget, to really analyze the case before going forward if you're going to use some method other than the hourly billing. Does that suggest that perhaps lawyers are either unable or lazy to sit there and do the planning? And that, of course, is before we talk about the requirement for agreement, as you suggested.
I guess I wouldn't use the word lazy, but I'd say it is not normal for them. I do, for example, construction litigation. And in the construction industry, contractors think nothing of spending, you know, hundreds of hours doing estimates and calculations and figuring out exactly what's going to need to happen in order to provide a fixed bid for the work they're doing. Now, obviously, there is more certainty in building a structure than there is in handling a lawsuit or doing a deal. But in addition to the uncertainty that's involved in the legal side of it, at least from where I sit, I don't think lawyers have the culture and comfort of spending a lot of unbillable time estimating fees and estimating work and doing calculations. So I'm not sure it's lazy, is they're not comfortable with it.
And of course, at least in my awareness, there's nobody teaching us how to do it.
I think that's right. I'm trying to think of people who, you know, would do the construction analogy of how you develop a bid, and I guess I don't think I've ever heard of anybody doing that.
Well, by virtue of the fact that we're having this interview today suggests that you have done that, and my question would be, how did you learn how to do it? I mean, is this all an OJT kind of a thing, on-the-job training, and you've spent many mistakes getting to the point where you can do it now?
Yeah, well, it's clearly on-the-job training. I certainly didn't learn anything about it in law school and can't think of any CLE I ever attended that helped me do it. I have developed budget forms that sort of lay out litigation tasks in great detail. And, again, if you go back to the construction industry analogy, contractors have computerized forms that, you know, lay out every possible thing that can happen on their type of construction. And when they do a bid, they simply go through their checklist and fill out the computer, and the computer generates what the ultimate cost is going to be. I have a similar form that I've developed over the years, and I literally go through and figure out how much discovery hours and how many case planning hours and how many airplane tickets and all that I think will necessarily go into the litigation we're talking about.
Well, other than doing the budgeting kind of thing that you're talking about and coming up with, I guess, would be a flat fee or a fixed fee, however we might describe it, what are some of the alternatives or other alternatives to the hourly billing?
Well, let me break it down into two pieces, because one is the alternative to the hourly rate, which allows you to sort of jump into the matter without really much ability or need to predict. The thing we've been talking so far is, when you need to predict, what's the process you go through to identify the tasks and the work and the time and the cost? Once you've done that, I may come up with a budget form that says $200,000, but then there is a completely different task. Now that you know, or you think you know, what it's likely to cost, what the client's willing to pay. You know, are they going to do a $200,000 fixed fee agreement? Do they want to do some incentivized thing? Do they want to? So once you've figured out the cost, or what you think is the cost, you move into something completely different, which is, how does the client want to structure a fee agreement in light of what everybody now thinks it's going to cost?
Well, that's interesting that you talk about cost in that context, because when you say that, what comes into my mind is the idea of, okay, how many hours is this going to take times whatever billing rate I want to make, that I want to charge, and that comes up with, quote, cost. Is that what you're talking about?
It's funny you would mention that, because that's precisely what I'm talking about. And I suppose, given the topic of this conversation, that shows sort of a subconscious holding on to the hourly rate, even though you're overtly not holding on to the hourly rate. That if I do a fixed fee contract with a client, it will be measured by me and my partners as whether I did better or did worse at the end of the day with a fixed fee, with an hourly rate engagement. And so, and quite frankly, I think that's exactly right. And I can tell you from my experience at two law firms in particular, where I've been in management, that as law firms are managed and partners are compensated and money is distributed, you know, how profitable you are and how much work you're bringing in is a significant element of that. And on a fixed fee basis, if you can do better than your brethren are doing in bringing in their hourly rate work, that's a feather in your cap. And if you do worse, then it's something that will be a detriment to your compensation. And so I guess I'm not sure whether it's sort of a psychological anchor to hourly rates or whether it's just a realization that if most people are still doing most of their work on hourly rates, when you do something alternative, that alternative will ultimately be compared against an hourly rate engagement.
And it seems to me that the anchor, to use your phrase, is really, and I'm not sure anchor is the right word, but the underpinning to the success of any method in the larger matter where you're dealing with the more sophisticated corporate America is that you've sat there and you've planned it, you've analyzed it, and I think that may be one of the differentiating factors, would it not, to the earlier or current method of just hourly billing where you just, what's the expression, aim and fire?
Right.
Or rather, fire and aim,
right,
rather than aim and fire. And what you're talking about is really aiming and then firing.
I think that's right.
Well, how does our discussion today play with in comparison to the ABA model rules of professional conduct and similar rules across the country, model rule 1.5, where we talk about the fee being reasonable? Is this impacted one way or the other, depending on which method of billing we use?
I don't think so, at least in the kind of work I do. I tend to deal with very sophisticated clients. Most of the individuals I'm dealing with as clients are lawyers themselves, are very well versed in all these issues. They know exactly who they're hiring, what they're hiring them for. They know what the marketplace is. They know what I charge. Even if I do it on hourly rate, I'm typically giving some sort of budget estimate, even if it's not binding. And for complicated legal problems, if a sophisticated corporation through its corporate counsel decides what I'm charging is what they need, whether it's an alternate fee or an hourly rate, I don't think that really implicates 1.5 at all. I think 1.5 is more directly applicable to when you're dealing with less sophisticated customers and the lawyer has an obligation not to take advantage of their lack of sophistication.
Well, Hugh, many lawyers believe that corporate counsel are merely trying to lower their legal costs and that there's no benefit to the lawyer. Can you describe what some of the benefits might be to the lawyer as well as to the corporate world?
Well, the primary benefit to the lawyer is you don't lose your client.
Well, that suggests that corporate America is moving and moving rather quickly toward something other than the hourly. Am I correct in understanding the subtext of your comment?
I would say they are moving. I would not say they are moving quickly. I think that there is no doubt that corporations are trying to take a more rigorous business-like approach to legal fees. The looking for other ways to measure performance of outside counsel on matters to generate compensation consistent with that, You know, I have personally worked on matters, relatively small matters for longstanding clients, corporate clients, where they are very, very cost conscious, and I've worked on very, very large matters that are of interest to the board of directors where cost is really not a consideration. So I don't know that you can make a general statement across the board, but what I do see is that in most areas of the corporation, getting bang for your buck, deciding what you want to purchase, what the parameters of the product you're purchasing are, and paying a fair price for that is a fundamental business philosophy, and I think that is clearly being injected into legal departments in ways that it hasn't been in the past.
And when we talk about fair, I suspect we're talking about the competitive fairness. Am I correct?
Competitive fairness, but also I go back to commensurate with the task at hand. If, you know, if you've got a relatively small product liability case, you know, the corporation looks at that as a cost issue. They want to manage that cost. There's no strategic significance, and so they want to manage that as cost effectively as they can. If they're doing a IP or trade secret case where the core technology of the company is at risk, they may pay a whole bunch more for legal services and consider it eminently fair if they're getting the best representation possible. So I really think it's not so much fair in the sense of what do I charge compared to what the guy across the street charges. It's fair in the sense of what do they think they're buying? Do they think they're buying the very best trial lawyer for their most serious problem, or do they think they're buying a good, competent lawyer to help cost control, you know, lawsuits as they come up in the company?
One of the critical elements of alternative billing, as I hear it explained, and as you discuss it now with the client, understanding what they're buying, that the more important the issue is to them, the less they're going to worry about what the cost of the legal service is that the lawyer has to move away from his or her attempt to be perfect, which is sort of counterculture to what we've been taught in law school. And it talks then about not leaving any stone unturned philosophy. How is it that the lawyer can work in this environment and not be subject to a malpractice suit?
Again, I think there are different stratas. I think you and I are talking about primarily representing sophisticated, significant corporations on the legal matters that they have. And in that world, I think the answer is communication. And quite frankly, I think malpractice is much less of a risk than just leaving the client unhappy and losing a client. You know, theoretically, even in a cost-conscious environment, you're going to do the things that, you know, provide minimum competent representation, so neither you nor the client would think you'd expose yourself to malpractice. But the question you're asking, I think, more directly is, within the bounds of competent representation, are there things you could or could not do that are really a matter of cost efficiency? And I think the answer is communication. If a client, and I've had this conversation many times with clients, that it's a risk. We can turn over all the stones and have a 10% better chance of wininging. Do you want to spend another $100,000 for a 10% better chance of winning? If you don't, let's identify the stones we're not going to turn over, and let's jointly recognize that we have created some risk that one of those stones may cause us some problems, and that's just a risk that we have jointly agreed we're going to take. And so I think if the lawyer makes those decisions all by themselves, I think they do take the risk of a client who's unhappy with those decisions. If the lawyer involves the client and it is a joint risk in pursuit of cost-effective legal services, I think that risk is very, very small.
When you talk about joint risk, I mean, what's the risk to the lawyer?
And I probably misspoke. I don't mean joint risk. I mean jointly decided, joint decisions about the risk.
Okay, because the way I heard it the first time, I get scared because as the lawyer, I don't want to take any risk.
And, again, I don't want to take a risk that my client hasn't agreed upon.
Right.
So if I, for example, there may be third-party witnesses on the East Coast, and we want to depose them. I've interviewed them, and I've found out they don't have a lot to say, but, you know, once I get them under oath, I may find some good stuff. Should we go spend $10,000 to depose the witnesses on the East Coast? Nah, let's not do that. Okay, it's a joint decision. If at some point it explodes and turns out one of those witnesses really did know something, you know, if the client is honorable and recalls that this was a joint decision, it's a risk the company took based on the joint decision between the client and the lawyer as to what were the elements of cost-effective representation.
Hugh, if one of the principal ingredients of alternative billing is that fees are paid by value rather than by time, who sets the value? And if the client sets the value, how does the client get educated to understand what the value is? And for that matter, how does the lawyer get educated to understand what the value is?
I think it is, that is one of the impediments to moving away from the hourly rate. And when you said corporations are moving and moving quickly, I said I didn't think they were moving quickly. And I think that this is one of the reasons. I think it is very difficult for either side. I mean, it's very difficult to predict just given the nature of at least litigation, which is what I do, to really make those judgments in any sort of objective way. And it is probably more difficult for the corporation. And so I think that a corporation has some hesitation to make sort of binding fixed fee type commitments, you know, when the case could settle in the first 3 weeks, and then all of a sudden the corporation's paying, you know, way more than it should. So I think it is just very difficult to determine value. It is very difficult to determine those sort of things objectively, which is an impediment to going to these alternative things.
Well, it's interesting because you said if the matter settles in the first 3 weeks on a fixed price matter, then the thought is it's sort of buyer's remorse in that the company is paying too much because they could have settled it, in fact did settle it early. But didn't they get value?
In the big picture, they certainly did. Well, actually, let me give you both sides of the answer. One side is, yes, they clearly got value because they got rid of a lawsuit that could have gone for years, and they could have spent hundreds of thousands of dollars, and they got rid of it quickly, and they saved management administrative time, and they got certainty, and so it was a great outcome.
And the bottom line is they actually did get what they want. They got extricated from the matter.
The opposite side of the argument is I paid this lawyer a gob of money, and he didn't really do anything. It may have settled for circumstantial reasons unrelated to, you know, the value that I contributed to the process. It may have been completely fortuitous. In fact, I will tell you, and this was on a fixed fee arrangement, I had a client where one of the other defendants filed a personal jurisdiction motion in a case filed here in Colorado. We sat around, didn't do anything for a couple of months while that was being decided. It was granted. That defendant was dismissed. The plaintiff then decided they were going to go to that defendant's home state, but then decided, because it was not a favorable forum, they just dropped the whole case. And so we got rid of the case from my client's perspective for virtually nothing. I did almost no work in the case. But under our it wasn't a fixed fee, but under our sort of schedule of fees, you know, I probably made 100 times my hourly rate on that. And, you know, we talked and negotiated and we did a compromise because I thought that was, you know, grossly unfair. But it sort of highlights that particular case had nothing to do with my talents or the value I added to the engagement. It just sort of worked out that way. And I would have been a huge fortunate beneficiary of circumstances.
Well, it's interesting because you describe your own psychological feeling of guilt in taking so much money. on the other hand, if it had worked out the other way and you were upside down in the matter, you wouldn't have felt guilty. You would have felt resentful that you're doing it for something less than what you, quote, should have gotten. Would you have been able to go back to the client and say, you know, this just isn't fair on the other side of the ledger, and you should be paying me more money than what we agreed to?
And I think the short answer to that question is it depends on the agreement that the parties have. I mean, I think you can agree with a client that it's an airtight, each side agrees to take the risk of fortuities and third-party events, and whatever happens, happens. Or you can agree that, you know, this is a semi-airtight thing, but both parties will consider if circumstances really work out differently. You know, if somebody files an antitrust counterclaim to a product liability case, you know, we're going to renegotiate. And almost all of the alternate billing arrangement things I've done have that element to them. The expectations of the parties are not that this is airtight no matter what. The expectations of the parties is this is an alternate way to price and value the services. We both think this will work out fair. We'll both take a risk of, you know, plus or minus 30%, but if it's more than that, and it's more than that for external reasons, we'll renegotiate.
Well, Hugh, one of the things I think that's sort of underlying here is the aspect that we're talking about litigation. And just as a side note, do you see this working in transactional matters, or is it still just for the moment limited to litigation matters?
I'll say two things. One, my expertise and knowledge in transactional matters is very limited, so I have almost a sort of a casual, normal citizen's view as rather than any unique lawyer point of view. The one comment I would make is I've read a variety of materials about Wall Street M&A deals, and the Wall Street law firms who make millions and millions on those kind of deals are incredibly resentful of the investment bankers who take 10% or 8%, and so the Wall Street law firm walks away with $8 million, and the investment bankers walk away with $110 million, and they're roughly doing about the same thing, you know, putting the deal together. And the bottom line is, I guess you could certainly go to it, but. I don't know what the pros and cons of it would be.
Well, if in our examples the client sets the value as priceless, or if the client says that the value is inestimable, and you get the desired result for the client, how do you determine that the fee to be paid? Would you base it on a percentage of the result, and if so, what would that percentage be?
I'm sorry, could you say that again? We have a fire marshal here who's yelling in the background, but he'll be done in a second. Go ahead.
Okay. If the client says that the value of the service to the client is priceless, or if the client says that it's inestimable, and you get the desired result for the client, how do you determine the fee to be paid? Is it based on a percentage? And if so, what would that percentage be?
The only real answer to that is it's got to be by agreement. I just finished handling a lawsuit for a huge multinational company where the issue at hand was something of board of directors level concern. And, you know, by any stretch of the imagination, the outcome was worth hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars to this company over the next 10 years. You know, there wasn't any serious consideration that if I won, I would get $100 million. I mean, you just can't look at it like that. They can say, we're willing to pay your rate, or we're willing to give you a premium, or we're willing to, but, you know, just because I achieved a result that resulted in a benefit of $1 billion to a company, you know, that doesn't immediately tell me at all what my fee should be. What my fee should be is whatever we agreed to. And so, in that particular case, we had a fixed fee agreement for the litigation and a bonus of an agreed amount if I won. And we did, and I got it, and that was what we agreed to, and it was a pittance compared to what was at issue in the case, but it was what we agreed to.
So you're saying that the mortgage bankers might be able to get a percentage of a result, but lawyers still are not in that position?
Well, I mean, you could. I mean, there, you know, there's,
I mean, other than the, you know, traditional tort contingency matters.
You know, one of the problems, I think, in terms of getting a percentage of the result is in a when you're on the plaintiff side, whether it's personal injury or, you know, there's a number at the end of the day, $6,422,381. In a Wall Street merger, the deal has a value of $38 million or $38 billion or whatever it is. So there's a number, and it's a relatively visible and objective number that you can apply a percentage against. Although I tossed around in my prior comment that this was worth hundreds of millions, even $1 billion to my client, that's a very nebulous sort of calculation. It had to do with the operational efficiencies, and, you know, there really wasn't a number that you could see on any piece of paper that would be the outcome number you could apply a percentage against. And I think particularly on the defense side, that's true. You can talk about saving the client tens of millions of dollars, but if you really got right down to it, it would be very difficult to pick a number against which you could factor some percentage.
Well, Hugh, if beauty is in the eye of the beholder, and in this case we're talking about value, and assuming that you have the client, so we're not talking about the competitive bid here, how might it, what would the process look like? How could you reconcile the differences in opinion of value between the client and the law firm?
You know, I think that's simple. That's a deal. Somebody wants to buy widgets and somebody wants to sell widgets, and they either agree that the widgets are worth 4 cents a piece or there's no deal. You know, I've had lots of clients who come to me and says, I have this big, huge case, and I want you to represent me, and I say, I charge what I charge, and they go, holy cow, I'm not paying that. And they go to somebody else. And so the answer to your question is, if we agree on what I'm going to charge, either by hourly rate or by alternative method, we have a deal. And if we don't agree, then we don't have a deal, and they find somebody else they can do a deal with. And, you know, it's I'm literally right now with a longtime client going to do a piece of litigation on a fixed fee basis, you know, subject to fairness reopeners that I mentioned before. And, you know, we've talked about it, and because we have a track record, I think it's very likely we're going to reach agreement, but it's always possible I could negotiate too hard or ask for too much, or they wouldn't value my services or contribution as much as I think they should, and they'd go someplace else.
Underlying what we're talking about is, I think, the need for the lawyer to really understand what the client wants, not what they say they want, but what they really want. And I guess, secondly, is the need for the lawyer to create a timeline both of costs and events to understand what this really looks like, or what's going to play out, at least as best the lawyer can understand the future. And yet we were never taught this in law school. At least I wasn't, and I don't think they're teaching it today yet in law school. How do lawyers intuitively know, in your experience, how to do this, or where do we go to school to figure this out?
I think it's on-the-job training, as you say. I think it would be hard to teach in law school. I mean, you could do a little bit of it in sort of introductory client business fee kind of things. But at the end of the day, this is a process about predicting. I predict that future events in my client matter, my lawsuit, are going to go this way and that way, and they're going to last about this long, and these are going to be the constituent elements. They're going to take about this much time. And because I've done lawsuits for 25 years, I have some high degree of confidence that we'll have a couple of motions to compel, and there'll be 30 depositions, and they're, you know. And it is that ability to look forward and see the process that is the foundation of saying, this is what I think the process will cost, or this is what I think the value is going to be to the client. And I don't even know how you can begin to embark on that process until you have a rudimentary knowledge of lawsuits and depositions and how they work, and not in the sense you learn in law school, but until you've been through it. So I don't really see how you could be in a position to quantify value or predict the course of lawsuits or transactions or whatever until you've done them for a while.
In other words, you're not going to build the Chrysler Building as an architect or as a contractor until you've built a few buildings that are 20 and 30 stories high to get the experience.
Exactly.
Is that what you're saying?
Exactly. And you're not going to know the approximate cost of building the Chrysler Building until you've done it a few times in the past.
So all of this comes back to the fact that a new lawyer couldn't do this. There's got to be an experiential factor. And with the pressures today, the competitive pressures today on the law firm, where clients are not willing to pay for the learning curve of newer lawyers, how is it that we can teach our newer lawyers the skills they need to know to get to the point where they're in your seat with your knowledge to be able to do these kinds of things for the kinds of clients that you have?
Ed, I think that is a classic conundrum faced by all businesses, and it's, short-term yield versus long-term investment. I can work an hour today on a billable matter and earn whatever I earn. Or I could spend time training younger lawyers in this skill or any other skill, or taking my secretary out to lunch, or doing other management things that don't earn me any money in this hour, but they are good uses of my time in investing in my enterprise. And so I don't think the dilemma lawyers are facing in the training of young lawyers in this or any other skill is any different than any businesses face. You can spend a lot of time earning money right now and not invest in the future, or you can find the balance in your enterprise of, current yield versus long-term investment. And, we do it a certain way. I do it a certain way, but I'm not sure there's any formula.
What kind of advice might you give to a newer lawyer coming in who, if he or she were to look down the pipeline as to the future of the profession, what kind of advice would you give to them so that they could be prepared for the kinds of changes that you might see on the horizon?
It's funny. I don't think I'd need to give any advice, because I think it's the old dogs like me that are sort of stuck in the past and resistant to change. And, every new client or corporate demand is an aggravation that needs to be dealt with. I think, the younger lawyers are, much less hidebound to the way things have been. And I think my only advice on this issue is my advice in general to younger lawyers, which is the customer is number one. The customer is always right. And if you're in the consulting business and you're a highly paid lawyer, you can sort of forget that and think the world revolves around you. But whether it's the definition of their legal needs or meeting their budgetary constraints or, recognizing that the customer is always right is the most important issue. One of the things that I have always tried to do and tell the people around me to do, when some client comes to you with some budgetary administrative documents or some new way of billing or an alternate fee arrangement or some arcane proposal that's new and different, and your first reaction is, oh my God, I got to figure out this, and I've got to do this differently, and it's more complicated than hourly billing, and I haven't done this before, and it's sort of a minor aggravation. The way I look at it is, this is a competitive advantage. If I can do this task, if I can respond to this change in process and procedure, if I can meet my client's needs at this administrative level better than my competitors, I'm faster on my feet, I'm more responsive, I'm more flexible in how I meet the need that's being expressed by whatever this change is, that's a competitive advantage I have. And I look at it that flexibility, that creativity, that responsiveness the client needs is a competitive advantage, just like giving a better closing argument than the guy across the street.
Hugh, on that positive note, I want to thank you for joining us today and sharing your views with a proposal for the future, if not already here in the present. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Ed. It's a pleasure talking with you.
You have been listening to a LawBiz podcast. For more podcasts, please visit www.lawbiz.com/podcasts.html. Feel free to tell your friends and colleagues about LawBiz podcasts. You may duplicate this program in part or in whole, provided that you retain appropriate attribution and copyright notices.